Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see? Pick up the mirror now, America. Go ahead, pick it up. What are you, afraid? It's just a mirror, America. What could it do to you except reflect your image? The Majority Report.
It is Wednesday, December 8th, 2010. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times. In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Quite a show for you today, folks. Joining us will be Christina Davidson. She is a writer for The Atlantic, and she's working on a book entitled Recession Roadie. She's been traveling the country, and I think is currently traveling the country. Not even sure. We'll have to check on that. Documenting essentially the impact of this recession and how people are dealing with it. And she has both some, I think, some sad stories to tell us and some inspirational stories. We're also going to be talking to a Virginia lawmaker who has a very interesting perspective on the TSA controversy. Yesterday, as we were signing off, or I guess, yes, as we were signing off, we were learning that Obama was going to have a press conference. Wasn't sure what it was going to be. It was essentially to defend, I think this is accurate, right, Dorsey? To defend his tax deal?
Yes.
Okay, thank you for your analysis. Evan, you want to add to that?
Sounds like Dorsey knows
great,
what's going on.
Great, 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 great. So Obama went on to have this press conference to essentially justify his tax proposal. Very interesting. I have some very interesting. Well, I don't know if they're very interesting, but I found it very interesting, and I have some thoughts on it that. You know, again, this guy is completely befuddling, but in the end, I think the answer, we all know the answer. All right, let's play the first clip. I should also say before we play this clip that there's some really disturbing information out there about this deal, what it doesn't include. We will get to that later in the program. This deal looks worse and worse to me as we go on, because from the very beginning, it seemed to me that from a policy standpoint, there was some argument for it in a vacuum. But, of course, policy never happens in a vacuum. And policy never happens just for this moment that it happens. Politically, I saw some real problems leading to policy problems down the road. But now it looks like there could be some real policy issues with this in the short term. And it appears over the last 24 hours that this deal, and maybe this is why Obama came out and gave that, you know, when we heard about this deal Monday night, I was doing countdown. We brought Sam Stein on, and he said, yeah, this, I don't think they would have announced this deal without it being pretty much a done deal. But it's starting to look like it may be a little bit less done than we had anticipated. But let's play this clip. We'll cover all this, but let's play this clip from Obama. This is a long clip. It's about 3.5 minutes long. Many of you have probably heard it. Some of you haven't. It's Obama scolding the left. I'll probably stop it as we go through, because there's some things in this I can completely agree with.
You know, so this notion that somehow, we are willing to compromise too much reminds me of the debate that we had during health care. This is the public option debate all over again. So I pass a signature piece of legislation where we finally get health care.
All right, let's stop here for one second. This gives you a little bit of insight into how personally Obama seems to be taking this. I pass a signature piece of legislation. Now, listen, you need to have a very healthy ego to be president of the United States. You need a healthy ego to sit in a closet and do a daily web talk show, frankly. And I can only imagine what would happen to your ego if you could look out and see two other people besides Evan or Dorsey sitting at $18 Staples tables. But it is interesting to hear him say, I passed the signature piece of legislation. And, of course, he's teeing up this notion about the public option. I want to remind people that the public option for the left was a compromise position. Right? I mean, you remember back in that, Obama himself, if I had my druthers, we'd have a single payer, but it's just not happening. So he proposes this public option as part of his plan. He was also the only person who did not run on the mandate in terms of the Democratic primary, which I at the time thought was a good idea. I thought, this guy's pretty clever. Nobody talks about Social Security as being a mandate, but that's what it is. It is mandated retirement insurance. Okay, good.
Where we finally get health care for all Americans, something that Democrats had been fighting for 100 years.
Not really 100 years.
But because there was a provision in there that they didn't get that would have affected maybe a couple of million people, even though we got health insurance for 30 million people and the potential for lower premiums for 100 million people, that somehow that was a sign of weakness.
Okay, pause it for a second. Now, he keeps referring to they didn't get the public option. Well, first of all the polling that I've seen suggests that they is the majority of the American people. So it's not just a question of the left wanted the public option. And it's not simply a question that the left wanted the public option because it would have helped only several million people. That's accurate. The vast majority of us would not be eligible for the public option. But the idea behind the public option was not just that it made a public option available to a small segment of the population, but that it would function in some ways as like a charter school is supposed to, as an experiment that shows there's another way of doing this that would necessarily, because it's more efficient, we know this from Medicare, it would create downward pressure on premiums and the way on the cost, essentially, emanating from private insurance, from the private insurance industry. It would put pressure on them to become less profit hungry because they would have competition that would suggest to them that, like, hey, if we don't get our shit together, people are going to figure out that it's much more efficient to have the government provide health insurance. There's no need for us. So it wasn't just about helping those people, but okay, good.
That somehow that was a sign of weakness and compromise. Now, if that's the standard by which we are measuring success or core principles, then let's face it, we will never get anything done. People will have the satisfaction of having a purist position and no victories for the American people.
Okay. Now, look, and here is where I sort of agree, at least in somewhat in principle, of what he's saying. You know, for years, people have been telling me, you know, I'm going to vote for blah, blah. I'm not going to choose the lesser of two evils. And that has always struck me as ridiculous. Voting is a very practical exercise. It is not it's not creating an art project. It's not about self-expression. And which is why, you know, there's no notion about being true to yourself when you vote. That's silly in my mind. Because you can be true to yourself all you want when you vote, but all it does is make you feel good about yourself. Your vote has implications, and you're deluding yourself otherwise. But are we talking about the same dynamic here? Because in the long run, are Americans actually going to be better with the compromises he's making?
And we will be able to feel good about ourselves and sanctimonious about how pure our intentions are and how tough we are. And in the meantime, the American people are still seeing themselves not able to get health insurance because of pre-existing condition. Or not being able to pay their bills because their unemployment insurance ran out. That can't be the measure of how we think about our public service. That can't be the measure of what it means to be a Democrat. This is a big, diverse country. Not everybody agrees with us. I know that shocks people. Now, the New York Times editorial page does not permeate across all of America. Neither does the Wall Street Journal editorial page. Most Americans, they're just trying to figure out how to go about their lives and how can we make sure that our elected officials are looking out for us. And that means because it's a big, diverse country and people have a lot of complicated positions, it means that in order to get stuff done, we're going to compromise. This is why FDR, when he started Social Security, it only affected widows and orphans. You did not qualify.
All right, stop right there for a second. Now, I agree with everything he just said. I agree with everything he just said. It makes complete and total sense. We're going to have to compromise on certain things. There are certain political realities. You know, not every newspaper, I don't want to get into his sort of, you know, the New York Times doesn't permeate, et cetera. Yes, correct. Correct. But the problem is that this guy must be living, I mean, either he's living, if he really believes this, which I believe he does, he's got to also be living in some type of bubble because he doesn't seem to be following where the middle is on these things. He just doesn't seem to be. That's the issue. The issue isn't that people have a problem with him compromising to get things done. The issue is that he's not compromising. He has had a larger majority in both the Senate and the House. He has had the American people on his side. He has not in any way activated that huge email list he's had. The problem is that he is either completely tone deaf and isolated from what the American people say, or as I think is really at the heart of the criticism of Obama, is that he is weighing not just the Republicans, what the Republicans want, but essentially big corporate financial interests and ideas as giving them more weight than what the American public wants, than the ideas on the left. That's the problem. Yes, you should compromise. Yes, you need to be pragmatic, but unless you believe, and this is the question I would ask Lawrence O'Donnell, because he is, again, emblematic in my mind. Very nice guy. Enjoy him as a person. Very nice. But he is emblematic of the left, self-identified left or liberal, that seem to think that every time Obama compromises, it's exactly as much as he could have gotten. Have you ever heard a single one of these defenders
ever say he could have gotten a little bit more? He was a little bit short. I mean, is it possible that Obama, every time he compromises here, lands exactly as far as he could possibly go? That's what we, I mean, I watched O'Donnell. That's what we are led to believe. This is as good as he could have gotten. He took it right up to the edge. Really? Really?
And yet now, it is something that really helps a lot of people. When Medicare was started, it was a small program. It grew. Under the criteria that you just set out, each of those were betrayals of some abstract ideal. This country was founded on compromise. I couldn't go through the front door of this country's founding. And, you know, if we were really thinking about ideal positions...
All right, I don't even need to hear any more about this. I mean, it's interesting that he brings up the fact that, you know, as a black guy, I could not walk through the front door when this country was founded. But, you know, the bottom line is nobody has a problem with compromise. The problem is what the compromise is. That's what's genuinely annoying about this. What's this other clip? Let's play the other clip. There's another clip from the press conference.
What do you say to Democrats who say you're rewarding Republican obstruction here? You yourself used in your opening statement they were unwilling to budge on this. A lot of progressive Democrats are saying they're unwilling to budge, right. And you're asking them to get off the fence and budge. Why should they be rewarding Republican obstruction then?
Well, let me use a couple of analogies. I've said before that I felt that the middle class tax cuts were being held hostage to the high end tax cuts. I think it's tempting not to negotiate with hostage takers unless the hostage gets harmed. Then people will question the wisdom of that strategy. In this case, the hostage was the American people, and I was not willing to see them get harmed.
Well, that's a wonderful sentiment, but it's, A, inaccurate. If you've been on unemployment extension for 99 weeks, you're harmed. If you make, and I'll talk about this more later, but if you make approximately under $40,000, you're harmed. You're actually going to be paying more in taxes. If Social Security is cut because of this deal, you're harmed. If, and this is a really scary revelation, I'm going to talk more about this. If the BABS, the Build America Bonds program, is not reinstated, you're harmed. The American people will be harmed. And to use his own analogy, you know what happens when you negotiate with the hostage? You also have a plan to make those hostage takers accountable. Right? The idea is that you give them the bus and they go to the airport to catch the plane as they try and fly to wherever they're going to fly, and you kill them on the road. Or you blow up their airplane. Or you put, or the guy flying that airplane is a, you know, is a commando. I mean, if we're going to use this type of rhetoric, let's play out this analogy. Because in this situation, you're not only in any way not penalizing these hostage takers, you're giving them everything. Here's the ransom. Just come back next week. We'll do this again. You must inflict pain on them in some fashion, because they're just going to take hostages again and again and again. I am one of those people who feel like, yes, sometimes you do negotiate with hostage takers. And then you track them down and you try and kill them or arrest them. You know, the kill them may be just more of a function of, like, watching too many Schwarzenegger movies. But you arrest them! You make it clear they're criminals! He's not doing that in this instance. He's not doing it at all in this instance. And, you know, we'll talk more about this. We got to take a break. But, I think it's very difficult to know who Obama is and what he really believes. There's a political story out there now saying that he trusts McConnell more than he does House and Senate leaders, Democrats. Well, maybe we need to focus on pushing our lawmakers to the left. And that seems to be maybe happening with this tax deal. And, God, we still got Pelosi there. We'll be right back. We're going to talk to Christina Davidson, the recession roadie. We'll be right back. We're back. We're back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, Christina Davidson. She is an Atlantic correspondent, a photographer, a book editor based in Washington, D.C. She specializes in editing books on national security, terrorism, and war. But you've been engaged in a different project, haven't you?
Oh, yes. I just started writing myself a couple of years ago, and it's funny, coming from a background in national security and terrorism, I really don't find myself enough of an, even though I'm a bigger expert than a lot of the talking heads you'll see on cable news, I don't really consider my expertise of the standard that I would feel comfortable writing about national security. So I've been focusing more on people and the recession and the effects of on our culture and our society of what's been going on in our economy and our country.
Now, you've been on. Now, are you back now, or are you still in
yes.
the process? Okay, so you
I'm back, but I'm making plans to do the whole thing again.
All right, well, before you say you're doing it again, which is pretty amazing, tell us what you did.
I took a 7-month recession road trip across 48 states. I drove over 20,000 miles, interviewed over 400 people about what their life has been like. Since the recession hit,
what did you drive? What kind of car?
A Prius, actually.
All right, that sounds good.
It's 40 plus miles to the gallon on average, which, you know, when you're driving 20,000 miles, can make a difference.
Yes, a huge difference. It makes a difference if you're driving 100 miles.
Yeah. Oh, hilariously, though, if you want to know something a little funny, GM was supposed to sponsor my trip and provide the car. And then they, you know, declared bankruptcy the week I was to leave. So
that's happened on every business endeavor I've ever been involved in, frankly. So that just brings up sad memories. So tell me. So now, I mean, I have a sense of why you'd want to do this. It's a very interesting project. What did you find?
You know, one of the biggest lessons that I took away from the experience, from the people I talked to, is that I suppose to put one word on it, it's a perception. The people who I met who hadn't experienced any direct impact from the recession invariably would have a greatly more negative response when I asked about it, about how bad things were, about how bad things had gotten. They would start complaining, oh, it's been terrible. We have to cut back on expenses. We have to do this. We have to do that. But, you know, every single person, the people that I spoke to who lost their houses, who lost their jobs, even people who've been made homeless would always say, well, you know, at least I've got food to eat tonight, or at least I've got my family, or at least I'm not homeless, or at least, you know, I have this shelter to keep me from sleeping on the streets. There was always a positive focus. And there was very often not only just a positive focus, but an appreciation for having the experience, even though it was a negative experience and it was a struggle. I heard so many times that the people who had really suffered because of the recession were grateful to have been given the opportunity to learn what's important. I heard that so many times. Family's important. Possessions, not important. You know? That's interesting.
So people who really didn't have any demonstrable problems with the recession because of the recession were far more self-pitying? Is that it?
Yes. Far more pessimistic, far more, emphasis on just how horrible everything was. They just had a negative outlook on everything. But the people who actually had suffered would be grateful for what they did have. It was just a completely different perspective on life and what the American way of life is supposed to be. I mean, you know, I interviewed this guy down in Texas, and him and his wife had lost their home in Las Vegas. They've been foreclosed on. They lived in this house for 18 years, I think, but made the mistake of refinancing at the peak, and then, you know, it just strangled them. And the day they walked away, he said, was the greatest day of freedom in their life, and they were living in an RV camp down in Texas. The two of them living in going from a 2,800 square foot house to a 28 foot RV, and they'd never been happier.
Huh. Interesting. And that sounds like was that par for the course, that people were actually happier in these situations, or were they just more hopeful and optimistic?
I've talked to a couple of psychologists about this, and there's certain kind of protective notions, kind of self-protective emotional responses that are involved. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it, you know, was when people are tested by fire, they come out stronger, and they come out with a new, you know, outlook on what really matters and what really is hardship. You know, you stop complaining about your sore neck when, you know, you don't know where the food is going to come from for dinner.
That's just
human nature. So there's a lot of that at work. And that's one thing that in the book that I'm writing on right now, I hope that I can communicate effectively so that people who read it can take away those lessons, you know, learn those lessons from the people who did really suffer from the recession. And so kind of spread that kind of understanding about what's important and what we should value in our daily life so that everybody can.
Has it lent you any insight into maybe just the notion, I mean, aside from it being a psychological response, and aside from it being a function of being able to appreciate what you have when you lose some part of what you have, is there also, did you come across the idea that maybe on some level the rampant consumerism and, you know, the idea of having to meet that mortgage each month is in some way a trap?
Oh, yes, no doubt. And I heard it described so many times. The people who got caught in that trap would just shake their heads and say, I don't know what I was thinking. It was like everybody was on drugs, you know, from their real estate agent to their mortgage broker to, and it was like once the ball started rolling, you don't really realize it until you wake up and say, I can't pay this. This mortgage is taking 75%
right
of my income. I can't do that. And it's funny. I really do think it was, you know, when the market was going at such a level and so many people were making money, a lot of people did get drunk on the potential and they just stopped thinking and they're embarrassed now. There's a lot of embarrassment at being caught in that trap because it's hard for them to say, I got trapped, and to push away the blame because I found few people who would not take responsibility for stupid decisions, but at the same time, they'll admit, I don't know what I was thinking.
Right. I think people get caught up in it in some level. Now, when you knew you were coming on the show, you wanted us to, and we've posted it on our blog, you asked for us to post a link to splitriverdesigns.com, and it's a couple that apparently has I'm not exactly sure what the story is behind it, but they've got great cutting boards that look like great
gifts. The cutting boards is an example. This is a perfect example of people who are proactively adapting their lives and their career ambitions to respond to the new situation. It's David Walters and Laurel Sprague. I met them down in New Mexico, but they're from Georgia. They've been living in Georgia, and David, his background, he's a woodwork worker, and he's always done, you know, cabinets and mantel really elaborate mantles and stuff like that, but, you know, when the housing market fell out, he was a small business owner. He owned his own business, and it just, you know, disappeared. It just evaporated.
Right.
And so he and Laurel decided to move. They'd never been to the Southwest. They picked up. When I met them, they were living in a KOA campground, and that's how they were paying their rent, by working at this campground. But David, because he's got a specialized technique, he decided rather than, since there are no businesses, there's no business in custom cabinets these days, he started doing those cutting boards and other kind of kitchen utensils, just so they're smaller and more, you know, sellable. You can sell them piece by piece. It's not such a huge investment. And now they're traveling the country in these craft festivals. This weekend they'll be at the Art and Craft Fair in Chantilly, Virginia. I'm actually going to go visit them. And they're making a good living doing this, just selling those cutting boards at craft fairs. And they're living in a trailer, a little travel trailer, wherever they go. And, again, they're loving it. It's not what they expected their life to be, but they love it. The one hesitation, the one thing that gives them fear, is the health insurance issue. Because mm-hmm. as self-employed, you know, unless everything gets worked out, they could face some serious problems trying to keep health insurance coverage.
Now, but, I imagine that you ran across a bunch of stories like this, and, you know, there's sort of there's that Lost in America feel to some of it. But what happened with families with kids? Because, I mean, I'm picturing that couple living in Georgia, but they have kids, and obviously
right.
it severely limits your options at that point, because you can't you can't do what they're doing, frankly, if you have kids.
Absolutely.
So what happens in those situations?
Well, you know, it's kind of, with kids, situation with kids, it can be a little bit scary. One thing that I found is families with children, it can be very scary, because there's a strong fear of having your children taken away. So families don't generally go to shelters. New families who are newly homeless don't generally go to shelters or social services. There's a big barrier for them to go out and get assistance if they're really, you know, struggling, because they're afraid that their children will be taken. And so it goes the same thing with somebody who's living a more nomadic lifestyle and moving around, not being able to register your kids. I mean, it's a challenge, and not being able to really go in public as much with your children, because you're always afraid that somebody's going to find out the truth and take away the kids. It can be very difficult. And, I mean, I could go into anecdotes, different specific anecdotes, but there's always some kind of individualized solution, you know, a lot of times. I met many people that, like, let's say the mother would move in with parents while the father would go traveling around looking for, you know, all over the country looking for work. That's not uncommon, to have one caregiver move in with extended family with the children. Or even to, you know, have the children move in with a grandmother or something while the parents dedicate themselves to trying to find work.
Right.
It really depends, you know, each case is different. Sometimes it holds the family closer together and makes them all living in one room, and sometimes they have to find arrangements so one can go out at far distances. And
I would imagine the presence of children makes the equation much more difficult, I think, in terms of even that sense of having more appreciation for their situation, because I think it's one thing to have that defense for yourself, but it's another one to know that you're putting your kids through something like that.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, listen, is there a place that we can go? Is this all in a book, or is there...
It will be soon. Don't worry. I'll be calling you again when the book's about to come on sale.
Okay, great. And is there a place where there are ongoing stories? When you do this again, are you going to maintain a blog, or...?
I believe it'll probably go back on The Atlantic, and that should start hopefully in May. I'll be back on the road.
All right, great. Well, good luck with that, and thanks for joining us. And folks, Split River Designs, cool... I couldn't tell how much they were.
I think they're about 40. I think it depends if you buy them online or if you go to the craft show.
All right. Well, folks, check it out. Split River Design. We have the link on our page at majority.fm. If you're looking for a cutting board or a nice, I guess, Christmas gift, Hanukkah, it would be a little bit late, but, you know, you can give like a coupon or something. All right, Christina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. We got to take a break, folks, and
How are we doing on time? I guess, let's, when we come back, Dorsey, can you try and get that guy on the phone? We're going to be talking to a Virginia lawmaker who has a very interesting theory on what's happening with the TSA. And then later in the program, we're going to go over this whole Build America Bonds issue, which is a very scary scenario. We'll be right back after this. We are back. This is the Majority Report. I am Sam Cedar. On the phone, we have a, as reported in by WTOP.com, WTOP, I guess a local, or WUSA 9 in Virginia. On the phone, Loudoun County lawmaker Gene Sniffa, a Republican representing Sterling on the Loudoun County Board of Supervisors. Welcome to the program, Mr. Sniffa.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here on such a dismal occasion, sadly, but it's still a pleasure.
I'm sorry, what, a dismal occasion?
I'm sorry. When you're watching the United States of America go down the toilet in such a fashion as it has, well, certainly over the last 20 years, 30 years since the hippie movement, and now today becoming a one-sex society, it's just, it's depressing. It's the work is tireless.
Excuse me for one second. I just want to, you have a very specific issue with the TSA new program using the Rapiscan. And if you don't use the Rapiscan, you are subject to pat-downs. And you have a rather odd perspective on this, if you don't mind my saying.
well, you know, I mean, I've heard people refer to my perspective as odd, and I question those people, and I question you, Mr. Cedar. But, yes, I have been conducting an ongoing investigative study myself and several interns have passed through no fewer than 769 different security operations throughout these United States.
So wait, are you suggesting now, okay, so you've been through 700 some odd security checkpoints at airports?
Bypassing the Rapiscan and doing the manual search, that's correct.
What was your findings on this?
My findings are is that the homosexual agenda in this country has effectively committed a coup d'etat in terms of forwarding their agenda, their ideals, their lifestyle, and their sickness, quite frankly, through this so-called safety security measure. It's a ruse. It's yet another example of how people buck the system and then have and take advantage of young people, old people. I mean, I've already been a victim of this, and I'm quite frank.
Could you please explain to my audience why you think this security system is part of the homosexual agenda?
What better opportunity for a person of same sex to place their hands upon the genitalia, the privates of another person for a little bit of a thrill? Oh, sure, we're going to keep you safe. At first, I just was shocked that, my goodness, I've been touched in a place that my wife barely touches me. And I'm thinking, that's odd. I don't even know this gentleman. On first appearances, he seems kindly enough.
Wait a second. Are you suggesting that the homosexual agenda was to set up these security things?
I'm proving it. I'm not suggesting it. I've proven it. On three different occasions just this week, I became more aroused during a security check than I've ever been in my life. Embarrassing, yes. Necessary, of course. But I'm not the only one. This is happening to young boys. this is happening possibly to young girls.
Wait a second.
If go ahead.
You're suggesting that because you were sexually aroused that these people, this is part of the gay agenda.
If it can happen to me, it can happen to anybody. Understand that I was raised Christian. I volunteered at my church, and I still am involved in the youth group. I run all the campouts. I do all the picnics. I do all the youth-oriented work. From there, I was a member of the Boy Scouts of America. Still am a card-carrying member of the Baden-Powell Council. I am as normal can be in these United States. And if I'm being aroused when a person of my own sex begins to fiddle and fondle and faddle my private area, I will tell you what, it can happen to anybody. I'm sickened by it. I'm embarrassed by it. But I feel my work is necessary work to stop the homosexual agenda. And these body searches, these manual... Do you know how many machines are now technically down? Sorry, our machine isn't working. Come this way.
How many more of these searches do you intend to engage in?
As many as it takes. If I have to go through one every day, I'll do it for the United States of America. I don't mind sacrificing myself like Mr. Rush Limbaugh, like Mr. Ronald Reagan, and Mr. Sean Hannity. I am of the idea that this is a great country, and it could be even greater. But many of us have to say the things we need to say and do the things we need to do. I will gladly throw myself on a grenade, so to speak. But in this case, it happens to be the wandering hands of a homosexual.
Well, sir, Loudoun County lawmaker Gene Sniffa, thank you so much for joining us. I don't know.
I don't find anything at all humorous about this situation.
Forgive me, sir. Good day to you.
One moment.
Oh, my God. Wow. All right. I don't know what to say. You know, it's a WUSA 9. I think if you look it up, you can see Virginia lawmaker claims pat-downs part of a homosexual agenda. Wouldn't be on the internet if it wasn't true, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, so getting back, we have 15 minutes left here of the show. I want to get back to a couple of stories before we get into this story about Bab. And we talk more about this tax deal. Elliot Spitzer, writing in Slate Magazine, Slate Online Magazine, I guess. It turns out that the Federal Reserve delivered an astonishing $9 trillion in short-term loans between 2008 and 2009. He's referring to the audit dump we saw of what the Fed was up to during the so-called financial meltdown. $9 trillion. And he says that what's shocking about the bailout is what we still don't know about them. We don't know what the banks knew about impending risks as the events unfolded. We don't know what the government officials who extended these loans asked before they handed over trillions of your dollars. And he says, he reminds us that part of the reason we passed fundamentally inadequate financial reform legislation, I mean, I have to tell you, now, obviously, on occasion, I go on Parker Spitzer. I am a huge fan of Elliot Spitzer's. I was a huge fan of his when he was Attorney General and when he was Governor. And I thought he did a great job on MSNBC when he was on. I think the Parker Spitzer show doesn't always necessarily play to his strengths. I, for one, thought having the Doobie Brothers on was a little bit odd, but that's not the issue. Elliot Spitzer, I think, is probably one of the best-spoken, most knowledgeable people in the country on these issues. And he is hated by these people. Hated. Because he was rude to them. Didn't treat them with the respect that they demand. So he reminds us that we passed fundamentally inadequate financial reform legislation
because the folks at the center of these events, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein, GE CEO Jeffrey Immelt, fought vigorously to keep the public from the public the critical information about the loans and the support they received. This is his proposal. In the waning days of the Democratic majority in the House, the relevant committee should require testimony from each of these individuals and subpoena every company that received more than $50 billion of loans and require that all their relevant accounting documents, sufficient to understand their condition at the end of each quarter in 2007, 8, and 9, be made public. He says the House should also subpoena and make public all emails between these companies and any government agency about the need for financial support and the prospects for the company absent federal assistance. This would be a great thing for a guy like Alan Grayson to get on pull one of those transpartisan coalitions. But it won't happen. Joe Lieberman, grandstanding again, of course, suggests that the New York Times could be investigated over the WikiLeaks. Could be. And, of course, where did he say this? On Fox News.
Surprise, surprise.
As reported by the Guardian UK, he told Fox News.
Surprise, surprise.
To me, the New York Times has committed at least an act of, at best, bad citizenship. But whether they have committed a crime is a matter of discussion for the Justice Department. In other words, they should be investigated. Lieberman also said the Department of Justice should indict Julian Assange, founder of WikiLeaks, under the 1917 Espionage Act, and try and extradite him from the UK. How is what Julian Assange or WikiLeaks did any different from the New York Times? I said this yesterday. I will say it again. I have not read a single cable on WikiLeaks. I don't even know if the site's still up. I've read it in the Washington Post, in the New York Times, in the Guardian UK. Bring them all in. You know, and it's not like Joe Lieberman gives a shit about the First Amendment. Remember how heavy metal music was poisoning the minds of all our children? I'm surprised you two guys are still here, because apparently around that era, you guys were supposed to be committing suicide because of your music, according to Joe Lieberman. State Department said spokesman Philip Crowley said yesterday what WikiLeaks has done is a crime under U.S. law. You know, actually, I think coincidentally, this week is the Freedom of the Press week, like established by the State Department, something like that. Honestly, Assange, of course, is in custody in Britain, awaiting extradition to Sweden. I'm not exactly sure what the charges are, sexual molestation, maybe one count of rape. I'm not exactly sure what they are. Doesn't matter. Joe Lieberman now has introduced an anti-WikiLeaks bill which would expand the Espionage Act to make it a criminal act if you publish the name of a U.S. intelligence source. Now, we know that it's illegal to leak the name, right? But now it's about publishing it. I wonder what the Supreme Court would say about that. Or I wonder what this Supreme Court would say about it. It's really more, I guess, an appropriate question. All right, back to the tax deal. This thing could be in jeopardy. And I am not convinced that it shouldn't be. Apparently, the Club for Growth and Senator DeMint have come out in opposition to the agreement. We will get a sense of how serious their opposition is when we see how many Republicans are going to support this deal. This is important because it is looking more and more likely that the Progressive Caucus in the House is going to take a stand on this. One of the biggest problems they have with it, the Progressive Caucus, is a function of the estate tax. Now, did you watch Lawrence O'Donnell last night, Dorsey?
I did not. Sorry.
All right. Well, that doesn't
it
help.
It sounds like he was in...
Well, you know, he had on a a panel including Jane Hampshire, Adam Green, Ezra Klein. I can't remember the other guy's name. Huh?
It's a good panel.
It's a good panel. And he was basically saying to them, you're all children. I have done tax legislation. You have not. You don't know what you're talking about. But he let them all say his thing, and then he had the last word, as he's wont to do. And he said...
Did he show a clip from the West Wing to make his point?
No, he did not. He did not. But, you know what would be funny is to actually be a guest on there and bring your own clip.
Makes your point.
Maybe. It's like, Lawrence, I want to show you a clip of Beat Cops. People were talking about how reprehensible the estate tax deal is, which is $5 million, and I can't figure out. I think it's $5 million per individual is my sense. Not quite sure. But I think it's $5 million per individual. Every dollar above $5 million per individual, in other words, if you both your parents die, you get $10 million tax-free. And then every dollar above $10 million, 35 cents tax on this. Okay? This is the tax that is levied so that we do not become some type of aristocracy in this country. Now, you know that if I was to give you, Dorsey, $13,000 as a gift,
yes,
I would not be taxed. Whether you were me or whether you were my son or just my friend. If I give you $15,000, it is taxed above $13,000. Okay? I get taxed on that $2,000. So I'm giving it to you. This is what the estate tax is, right? Mm-hmm. It is a tax. But this only kicks in $5 million for an individual under the Obama plan. So if you're, you know, Sam Walton and you're giving your kids $1 billion, it's all tax-free except for the last five. And here's the argument, right? Here's the argument. This money's already been taxed. You can't tax it again. It's already been taxed. When I earned it, it was taxed. When I got, you know, when I got capital gains, it was taxed. Okay, let's assume that every one of those dollars has been taxed. Dorsey, I'm going to give you a dollar. Do you know how many times that dollar's been taxed? Hundreds, thousands of times. Every dollar in your pocket has been taxed over and over and over again. Just because you're giving it to your children or whomever you really want, actually, upon your death, the fact that it's going to be taxed again doesn't mean anything. Every dollar you have has been taxed more than once. It's you are not going to be taxed on it again. It's whoever is going to receive this income is going to be taxed on it. Never mind the moral or the societal benefits for it. Just in terms of sheer fairness, this is not a multiple tax. And here's the other kicker. That if this tax was at $3.5 million per person, 98.3% of the American public would never be subjected to this tax. Never, ever, ever. This is a tax that is levied on 1.7% of American citizens. At $5 million threshold, it may be less. And do you know how much money that 1.7% controls of this country? Over 20%. So this is an offensive rate, and O'Donnell, of course, said, "You are all children! Do you not realize that the Bush estate tax is at 0% right now?" And he's right. This year, there has been no estate tax. So, someone pointed out on the IM, if you were the Steinbrenner family, you were lucky. You got the Yankees tax-free. Mm-hmm. Ooh. And I should also say, I hope you... but what happened with that Jeter? Oh, forget about it. I'm not going to get into a Red Sox Yankees.
Careful.
But what Lawrence failed to mention was that on December 31st at midnight, the estate tax kicks back in.
and it goes to over 50% on estates above $675,000. Now, in July of 2009, the House, the democratically controlled House, voted to institute the estate tax at $3.5 million per person at a rate of 45%. Anything over $3.5 million that you pass down as an individual, $7 million as a couple, anything over that amount would be taxed at 45%. So if you're getting $10 million from your dad, you'd get the first $3 million tax, $3.5 million tax-free, and then the next $6.5 million, you would get 45% of it, I don't know, about $3.5 million. I understand. Your father's a pain in the ass. I get it. You earn that money. I get it. Believe me, I get it. But the notion that somehow you should have been taxed twice. Not while you've had it. Not while you've had it, Chief. And so it seems to me there's a certain amount of leverage here, right? Democrats passed this bill by in the House. Republicans scuttled this bill in the Senate. The Republicans are going to control the House. They're going to institute, they're going to try and change the estate tax. Seems to me there's some leverage there. That's one element to this tax deal that the Progressive Caucus seems to have a problem with. The other issue, frankly, should be that, and contrary to Lawrence O'Donnell saying that the tax rate on the lowest quintile is 10% now, is going to be raised to 15% if Obama was to let this expire. Well, that may be the case, but it turns out that individuals who make less than $20,000, families with earnings below $40,000, are going to be the only group that likely have a tax increase because of this. Why? Because it does not include an extension of Obama's signature tax cut, the Making Work Pay credit, which was part of the stimulus plan. It provided a credit of up to $400 for individuals, $800 for families of low and moderate income. It replaces that with a supposed one-year reduction in Social Security payroll taxes. But the Making Work Pay tax credit was actually more money for people who make $40,000 as a family. So they're actually a little bit worse off. This is ignoring the fact that how easy is it going to be to reinstate that Social Security tax, which FDR said was the linchpin of maintaining Social Security. If people are paying into Social Security, it becomes that much harder for a politician to cut Social Security, to get rid of Social Security. But if you mandate that they pay less into Social Security and slowly chip away at it, then cutting it becomes much easier. That's the politics of this. And then there's this distressing thing, and we'll take the time out of our post-show because this is a very important story. I'll get to the other ones tomorrow, but this is a very important story. Found this at Digby, traced it back to, she linked back to Naked Capitalism, which I would recommend for everybody, blogs. An alert from James Puthukus of Reuters, forgive my mispronunciation, but what are you going to do, Chief? Can't tell you how many shows I've been on where they call me Seder until I finally go, hey, you know, I've been on the show a half a dozen times. Let's just do Seder this time. Just get over it. James Puthukas of Reuters, or Reuters, I don't know. Congressional Republicans appear to be quietly but methodically executing a plan that would, A, avoid a federal bailout of spendthrift states, and B, cripple public employee unions by pushing cash-strapped states as California and Illinois into to declare bankruptcy. Do you understand what's going on here? For months, if not years, the right wing has been specifically targeting government workers as making too much money, as having too good of pensions, as being the problem with our society, when in fact, for years, they were always lagging behind the private industries. But private industries have dropped, and study after study has shown that if you adjust for education level and qualifications, government workers do not make any more than their counterparts in the private sector. What is missing from President Obama's tax deal with Republicans is a provision to continue the Build America Bonds program, which accounts for 20% of new debt sold by states and local governments, thanks to a federal rebate equal to 35% of interest costs on the bonds. In other words, the federal government has been essentially subsidizing the interest on these bonds that state and municipalities must pay to people who loan them money. Do you follow this? Dorsey, do you get this?
Sorry, I'm trying to tweet out the article to everybody.
Oh, well, I'm trying to figure out if this is understandable. If you buy a municipal bond or a state bond, you are loaning money to that state or city. Mm-hmm. The state then says, okay, thank you for the loan. We're going to give you, let's just call it 5%. Okay? I don't know what the rates are. I'm going to give you 5% for loaning us the money for the next 10 years. I'm going to use these municipal bonds to meet my obligations, my budgetary obligations to finance new capital projects, infrastructure, whatnot. I've got to pay you 5%. That's a costly. I've got to pay you this. I got to return this money and plus 5% in 10 years. The federal government says to the state and the city, you don't have to return them 5%. You only have to return them 3.5%. We'll pick up the other 1.5%, making that money fairly cheap for you. Okay, great. 10 years at 3.5%, that's a great deal for me. If this program, which subsidizes that interest, is cut, cities and states will not be able to afford to loan to borrow more money, to finance things like these short-term and mid-term revenue deficiencies because we're in the middle of a recession. And they have less tax revenue because everybody's in a recession. They have less revenue because property values have gone down so much that they've had to reassess the property values and they're getting less property taxes. So states and municipalities are hurting. The one thing that has been keeping them somewhat afloat is federal assistance that came through the stimulus and this Build America Bonds program. Estimates of the state's unfunded liabilities to pay for retiree benefits range from $750 billion to more than $3 trillion. If they do not have the ability to borrow this money during this period where revenues are down, they're going to have to declare bankruptcy. And when they declare bankruptcy, their contracts with unions are null and void. And so there is some speculation here that the Republicans are very happy with this deal because it does not force the renewal of the Build America Bonds program, which means there's some conjecture that the GOP, this is from Naked Capitalism, the GOP is willing to shoot the economy to precipitate a crisis with the hopes of forcing the most favorable resolution possible to a long-standing desire of theirs, destroy federal, state, or particularly state and municipal unions. Break the unions. And Digby adds that in Peter Orszag's piece in the New York Times, I believe it was, or somebody quoting Peter Orszag about the Federal Debt Commission. Remember now, Rorty Baum, I don't know if he told us this yesterday, but he certainly wrote about it, This deal is exactly what Peter Orszag, Obama's former advisor and budget director, who left, I think, in September. As soon as he left in September, he wrote a piece, and he's headed to Citibank, incidentally.
Surprise, surprise.
He wrote a piece in the New York Times outlining what the deal should be. This deal that Obama announced is exactly word for word what Orszag suggested. And Orszag, in response to the debt commission, said, "It may take a fiscal shock, such as a drop of confidence in state or local bonds, that spreads to the Treasury market to spur action on the commission's proposals." If cities, states cannot get this Build America Bonds program, they become in serious jeopardy of defaulting on their loans, declaring bankruptcy. This stuff spreads like wildfire to other municipal and state bonds. And Orszag said that if that happens, it may actually spur our the debt commission. It may spur the debt commission stuff to be picked up. All right. Build America Bonds, folks. Go Google it. Tell your congressman, if they're a progressive, that you insist that this isn't the deal. That's the new deal. All right. I will take your calls now. We don't have that technology yet. Folks, listen, I'm going to tell you something. We're going to sequester the post show soon. So get it while you can. And by sequester, I mean it's going to be available only to members. We are now nearly complete with our members' video. The email will probably go out tonight to existing members. We will ask for your swag requests if we haven't gotten them already at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Please, folks. We need your memberships to continue this program. And we're going to sequester the post show as soon as we figure out the technology, which it appears we've moved. We have the architecture. We have the architect. We got a big shipment of JustCoffee.coop from JustCoffee.coop yesterday. Super psyched. Nikki, the happiest I've seen her in ages. Folks, forget about all those how to make your marriage work books. JustCoffee.coop has been the best thing that's happened to Nikki and I in ages. Los Diosos, that's her favorite. And, I don't get to choose. I have a different favorite. Doesn't matter. Moot. Completely moot. All right, stick around. You can IM me at Majority FM for the post show. And see you tomorrow. Chris Hayes will be joining us. You know, folks, I neglected to mention that Elizabeth Edwards passed away on Monday night. I had reported on Countdown that she was obviously gravely ill and sent a message out on Facebook, essentially, what I guess was a goodbye message to her friends. And she was 61 years old. She passed on. Did I announce this yesterday?
No.
I can't remember. Real shame. You know, I mean, I'm sure it's very easy to find a lot of people who were incredibly impressed by her. You can go to Think Progress. They've got a backlog of a lot of the policy statements she wrote about healthcare.
I think it's very, very easy to make the argument that to the extent that we got any health care reform this year, it was as much of a function of her work as anyone's. Because say what you will about John Edwards, and there's a lot of not good things to say. His campaign was the driving force for healthcare to become such a relevant topic. And she was the driving force for his campaign to make it a relevant topic for his campaign. So I just wanted to note that. I meant to do it during the pre-show, the other show. But it doesn't matter. Hopefully you're still listening. And, you know, you probably know this already anyways. It's a real shame. It's very sad. Let's go to the IMs. Nefertiti, the first thing I have on my list to do after the show today was to email you and thank you, but now I have the opportunity to thank you in person. I cannot tell you. I should have taken a photo of the look on. Look at Evan is like beaming now. She sent us a Nefertiti sent us a coffee pot. What? Turn the camera on you.
We're going to get so many things done.
Turn the camera on you. He's blushing. He's so excited. Oh, you do have the camera on you?
Yeah.
Okay. Look at him on the Sammy cam. He was so excited. I mean, Dorsey was pretty excited too. But Evan's like.
Having a problem.
It's like Christmas. I don't have to be there when Evan opens his presents under his Christmas tree. I saw it. Like, he got the coffee, but he's like, oh, my God. So excited. And so we're figuring out the perfect place for it. We just got the coffee, coincidentally, on the same day, right? Or the day.
Yeah.
And Nefer sent us filters. And last night, had a small Hanukkah party at my house. Mila's friend Judah came by, John Benjamin's son. John Benjamin's not a very good father and has left his family to do work on his television program in California. So, and really, his son really looks after me as a real father. It's very important that boy has a strong male presence in his life as opposed to the presence that Benjamin lends him. Anyways, be that as it may. And we used the napkins, the Hanukkah napkins that Nefer sent. And tonight I'm going to give Mila the Wizard of Oz little figurines, and she loves those. I'm a little bit concerned that you told me they're collectibles because, you know, to put a collectible in a five-year-old's hand, so I'm not sure what to do about that. But and Nefer also reminds me that the in 06, the cutoff was $2 million for the estate tax. I mean, frankly, you know, my sense is, I don't have the statistics to back this up, but my sense is that there's not much between 2 and 5 million people. Two and 5 million, you know what I mean? But, you know, it's like if you got 2 million, you get 6 million. Although, you know, part of this, I think the theory is that because of the irrational run-up of property values, people were addressing that. Now, in 2007, it made sense that I had an apartment. You know, I've been living in an apartment for 30 years in New York City. I bought it for $60,000, and now it's worth $8 million. And, you know, I have some sympathy for someone who's like, I've been living in this apartment for 30 years. My parents died. They left it to me. And now it's over. Well, you know, my dad left it to me, let's say. I mean, but, you know, the thing is, like, it's an $8 million apartment. Your mother could leave half of it to you. Your dad has the other half. And then when your dad gives it to you, you can get it. But the point being that it would have to be a pretty nice apartment. $10 million apartment. I wanted to keep the $10 million apartment. But
Actually, no, $10 million apartment you could get for free. If there was any other assets they had, let's say they had $1 million. So my folks lived in a $10 million apartment. They had $1 million in assets. I got the $1 million. I'm going to have to pay 35% on $1 million. I'm going to have to pay $350,000 in taxes to get that $10 million apartment. All right, well, here's what I would suggest to you. Rent that $10 million apartment for 4 months. For a year. You move out for a year. Rent it. Or reverse mortgage it. You have a $10 million apartment. You're going to get it for $350,000 in that situation. Or $450,000 if we have my way. If it's my way. You got a reverse mortgage. I think you'll be able to you find that it'll be very easy. That $10 million apartment. Kenny Mack, I heard someone say last week the Dems could extend all the cuts, then repeal the cuts for over $250,000 through reconciliation, since that doesn't raise the deficit. Such a dickish GOP move and the kind of thing Dems will just never do. I believe that because we're talking about taxation, yes, you could do it through reconciliation. I believe. I'm not sure about that, but I believe. Macintelligence, Sam, I feel like I am being gutted. I don't have the answer, but that presumes there is one. Of all the people I listened to, and last night I started on DFA conference with Senator Sanders. Then I watched three in a row on MSNBC. The hosts, Oberman, Maddow, read my mind, but goddammit, O'Donnell's written tax law in the Senate. Yeah, I know, he said that. My gut check tells me he knows what he's talking about. I wouldn't be so sure. He was also convinced there was absolutely no way health care reform will pass now that Scott Brown. It's impossible. You cannot do this, do reconciliation. Am I right? Did he not say that with an incredibly definitive tone? All right, sometimes people make mistakes. I make mistakes. There's no way to unshit the bed on failures to sell in the last 2 years. I'm a pragmatist, and pragmatism demands that we do not cut the president off at the knees, that we do not weaken the presidency. I don't know about that. One party is the adult, if cowardly about tax policy. The other is in la-la fantasy Santa Claus. When they play Santa Claus, we wind up with the bill, which literally claps us in irons. Our agenda goes into the dumper. Yes, I recognize that this deal is Groundhog Day. There's going to be huge blowback about adding $1 trillion to the debt, but I think it's possible that the deal gets dumped because it's not paid for. We have to start talking sense to the American people about tax policy. We have to make more Americans see the utter stupidity of the thug aisle tax. Oh, and Joanne Hamzer's cross-partisan approach is nibbling the crust. Lame. No surprise about the Build America Bond bullshit. Union busting is one of the Republicans' union. Okay, I mean, I just don't know at what point, you know, we say, like, we've got to, you know, look, I don't know if you're weakening the presidency by not taking the deal. Maybe you are, maybe you're not. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe emboldening Nancy Pelosi is a good thing. Maybe strengthening her is a good thing going into the, maybe those 70 progressive in the Progressive Caucus, or maybe 80. How many in the Progressive Caucus? More, right? Now it's gotten bigger. It's certainly bigger proportion to the size of the Democratic contingency in the House. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe Obama needs to be weakened a little bit more so that he starts to perceive the center in a different place. I don't know what the answer is. Thanks for the theme music, Dede Fru. Oh, and thank you for the membership, Dede Fru. Now, Dede Fru has the same email address as I am, so I know who that is. I know who you people are. No one escapes my ability to read IMs. The Virginia lawmaker must be a joke. I got to tell you, the one that we had on was, But not the one in go Google Virginia lawmaker claims pat-downs part of homosexual agenda. We didn't really have to do anything, folks. I changed the guy's name. And I really did actually like go back and forth on that. Like, what if he sues us? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Probably a good thing. Bad, but fuck it. Change the name. Lieberman, oh my God, I did watch O'Donnell last night. I watched O'Donnell just to imagine how much it better would be in having you doing the show. Well, no, look, I think his show is good. And, you know, I compliment him on having people like Adam Green and Jane Hampshire on and Ezra Klein. And I compliment him on that. Dede Fru, thanks to you and Digby for this invaluable info. Well, it's really Digby and naked capitalism via Digby. And, you know, but, I mean, I could do, frankly, I mean, it's not like I'm going out and, you know, doing the reporting on this stuff. The vast majority of things that I present to you are things that I have read on the blogs. I perceive one of my services to you is distilling these things and doing, reading. You can't believe how much I read in the course of the day, how much of this stuff I read. I don't do anything else. I literally do not do anything else. I go to the back. There's two things I do. Words with friends. Once, as soon as I send that off and I wait until someone responds to me on my words with friends, then no matter where I am, and I mean no matter where, I am reading this stuff to look for stories to tell you. Try for info on Virginia lawmaker will Google. Okay. Chris, 64, who's performing that fascist Bound to Lose song that is Billy Bragg and Wilco on Mermaid Avenue Volume 1?
I think it's 1, yeah.
And it was Woody Guthrie song that he never actually got to. There's actually, I think...
No,
if you,
no, sorry, it's Volume 2.
Volume 2, oh, sorry. If you read Bob Dylan's memoir, I can't remember which one. Has he only done one?
I think so.
He talks about the story about going to see Woody Guthrie and then going to, he was supposed to go to Woody Guthrie's, I guess, wife or girlfriend's place in Mermaid Avenue to get a box of songs. I think after he died or something like that, or anyway, when he was in the hospital. A box of songs he had written. And he never went to get it. These are those songs that Billy Bragg, I'm pretty sure that's the story. Crackpot, is he wearing a tinfoil hat? Can you blame her? So all the TSA. I got my friend Matthew. Bad. Bad. Bad, dude. Oh, I'm going to take a screenshot of your IM. Because he's going, you know, at 12:13, he's going, crackpot. Is he wearing a tinfoil hat? Can you blame her? And he's going, so all TSA officers are gay? Question mark, exclamation point. W2ETF. Why is he aroused? Question mark. Keep him away from young boys. OMG. This is a put on, right? Who is this for real? But the story is actually real. Republican Randy Altschul is conceded defeat to four-term Democrat Tim Bishop in the race for the last disputed U.S. House seat in the country.
Charge.
I'm going to take a screenshot of that, Matthew. Scales 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm getting no sound at all. Oops, I do. Mac Man, if he became aroused, that makes him gay. There's some deep homosexual repression going on inside that guy. Daddy Zhang, really want to move to Loudoun County after that? Krugman called it. Throw Mama from the Train Act. Abaddon, there was a time where I would have assumed that legislator was just a sketch you cooked up. Now I just don't know. Well, you know, again, it's both. I mean, this article...
This is what he said. I mean, I'm going to read. I'm going to quote him. The TSA's non-discrimination hiring policy is, quote, the federal employee's version of the gay bill of special rights. Quote, that means the next TSA official that gives you an enhanced pat-down could be a practicing homosexual. Secretly getting pleasure from your submission. And then he goes on to say that the Student Non-Discrimination Act would, in Congress would turn America's playgrounds into homosexual breeding grounds. You folks didn't know that that fanfare was actually a secret homosexual code for turning America into a gay breeding ground. That's what would happen. The prince would walk in wearing tights into the ballroom. You'd hear code back in the, I think it's like the 17th century for let's get gay! Kev, 11-7-21. When it's just as hard to make your 101st million as it is to make your first million, then we'll always have a level playing field in this country. You have a send us an email. We'll send you the mailing address. Send us an email, Kev, at majorityreporters@gmail.com. State tax is actually about $20-25 billion a year in taxes, so why LOD says it's great we're getting it back, and implies that it should have been gone... have been gone in the first place. And we just took a cut on the income of a few billion a year. See tax stats at a glance. When this whole thing started, I was under the impression that perhaps he was getting Dream or Start along with a decent amount of stuff, at least something close to the value of the 250K Plastux, which is $70 billion a year. But it turns out Obama's just getting piddling nothing except for more tax cuts, a tiny extension on unemployment, nothing else but more tax cuts for tax cuts. Color me massively disappointed. Jim DeMint doesn't even like it. He won't even vote for it. So despite the epic implosion of Obama, DeMint can't be even asked to vote right. That's right, Svengali. Visit Svengali's blog. What is it? The Mad Economist?
Diary of a Mad Economist.
Diary of a Mad Economist. Optimal Tomatoes just became a member. You really should make more membership pitches in Kissinger's voice like you did yesterday. Can't really afford it, but I can't say no to the old German pickle pus. Please, I don't, you know, if you can't afford it, you can't afford it. But, you know, kind of, do you really need that protein tonight in dinner? Honestly. Don't be a putz. Obama may not be a secret Muslim, but it appears he is a secret Republican. Though his track record at Harvard on the Law Review was exactly like this. Everyone thought he would be progressive, but he actually spent his entire time trying to get the conservatives to like him. He really seems to have a man crush on the Republicans. It's like he's trying to get into a restricted country club. I mean, I think that there is something, you know, to this. I don't know that he's trying to get into a restricted country club. I don't know if it's that as much as... Look, I have no idea what it is to grow up in this country as a black person, or what it does to your psychology in terms of what you must do to succeed in an environment like the Harvard Law Review. You know, there is. Someone could write a book. You know, one thing that sticks out in my mind is a book I read in law school about this one. You know, there's always like a bunch of books that stick in your head for years and years, and this one has stuck in my head for ages. That and The Phantom Tollbooth. But this one was called Parvenu and Pariah, and it was about how. Brandeis and Frankfurter viewed their Jewishness and how their Jewishness informed their decision-making on the Supreme Court. And Frankfurter tried to more or less assimilate. He felt that he was a pariah and was always trying not to be a pariah, and so he tended to rule with those who ruled for not the little guy, for not the underdog. Brandeis, whether he was on the Supreme Court or in the World Zionist Congress, always sort of brought to that organization the opposite perspective that got him in there. So on the Supreme Court, he advocated for the disenfranchised. On the World Zionist Congress, he advocated as someone who was assimilated. I'm sure someone could do a study of, you know, what it is to be a highly successful, by that I mean reaching the highest heights of American society as a black person. That your experience has informed your perspective. So, but, you know, at the end of the day, it may not matter. In fact, I know that it doesn't matter. Because even if you were to be able to go like, okay, look, I'm going to tell you, I was Obama's psychiatrist for 15 years. He was on the couch every day in my office. I can tell you exactly what needs to be done to get him to do what you want him to do. We could never organize everyone in such a way to get them to do that, right? I mean, so it doesn't matter if you have the secret key to Obama's psyche. It's interesting to talk about. At the end of the day, it could be just let's empower as many progressives as we can who are lawmakers who may have an outcome and leverage them. Sandy McGee, kudos to Neffer. I am now a wonderful member of the Majority Report. O'Donnell has a huge ego. No? I don't know. Great job refuting the double tax thing and for re-explaining the Social Security trap. I finally got it this time. Maddow had a great show yesterday on the tax cut compromise. Note the triple double quotes. Missed the beginning of the show. Are you as pissed off about Obama's lefty bashing as I am? By the way, there's no sound on the Sammy cam.
I'll fix that. Give me a sec.
Well, we're about to say goodbye. What drives me nuts is that the people who stand to benefit from no estate tax would never vote for a Democrat. Major follower, a new article on Yahoo News saying Obama is telling the Democrats if they don't support his deal, they will be responsible for the lack of jobs. Obama told the Democrats, America's watching, it's good that he's okay to fight his own party, but not the Republicans. Right. It's the Democrats' fault. Of course it is. Jesus Christ, Sam, what are we going to do with Obama, says Dr. Matthews. I was just listening to his presser on my way to work and outraged. He made me ride my bike twice as fast. That's not a bad thing. What do you think about the fact that Obama implied the public option was the purest position? Well, did you listen to the beginning of the show? Listen to the beginning of the show. Filthy Cleo, what is your words with friend's name? No, Filthy Cleo. That's not happening. Homosexual breeding grounds, those are called IVF clinics. Kevin Semicolon, Los Diosos is okay. What's your favorite? I've been drinking the WTF blend out of obligation, but I don't like it that much. I like this, the Maya Super Dark. That's the way I like that. But Nikki's like, too dark. Well, you know what I do? I drink what she tells me to drink. Speaking of Mermaid Ave, there's a good podcast which uses unwelcome guests as its theme song. The podcast is called Unwelcome Guests. Fair enough. Shanksoft, HGs from TSA are tax-free, though. Oh, God!
J. David Lara, I think I asked you this a year ago about the subtle hypocrisy of conservatives, such as Goldwater's view on gays and civil rights, and his grandson came out as a homosexual. Nancy Reagan regarding stem cell research, right? Jim Brady on gun rights, Liz Cheney, don't ask, don't tell. What do you think about this? By the way, finally became a member. Ah, thank you! I think Republicans tend to, you know, particularly libertarians. Libertarians always have a certain flexibility in terms of what they think government spending should be spent on based upon what they want. Dude, you can only get a reverse mortgage if you're a certain age, like over 60, or maybe it's 62. Well, you can get a home equity loan if you have a $10 million house and you need to pay off $350,000. I think you're going to be able to get a loan. I think you could probably refinance the house. But I want it for free. I want that $10 million house for free. I earned it. My father was a dick. Every day I had to sit with him at dinner. Now, I understand. No, the Virginia lawmaker is actually like a county supervisor. Dede Fru, you have a great day. Crystal Count, Revolution Roast is good. That's true, too, actually. I love Revolution Roast. I like the darker ones. I think Obama may weigh every division with the fact that historians and media will gauge all future blast presidential candidates by his actions, says Kev. I think that's true, too. I think that's true, too. Saw Modern World's cartoon yesterday. If that's the one with Middleman. Don't be a putz. If Senator like Jim Bunning can single-handedly derail unemployment insurance, why can't Feingold take this bill down? That's a good question. When will you give members a choice of swag? Can we also have the joy to pay for it to help the show more? Oh, my goodness. Majority follower. We'll start selling stuff. Dre Demanthes did not listen to the beginning show, but did sign up as a majority reporter. Can I get a shofar too? Are you kidding? Are you kidding? Seriously? All right, folks. See you tomorrow. Chris Hayes will be joining us. Always a pleasure to talk to Chris Hayes. Just one of the smartest guys out there. You know, I got to say, I will have Tom tomorrow on. I have to say that we get very smart people on this show. That's what is so great about this job. Like, there's certain things I don't know. You're like, oh, wouldn't it be great if I could just, it's like the promise of the web, right? It was like what Ask Jeeves was supposed to be. All right, folks, see you tomorrow. I guess somewhere the choice is made.